You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Brooke Neubauer, founder and CEO of the Just One Project. Brooke, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I love being on your show.
So for those who aren't familiar with the organization, what is the Just One Project?
The Just One Project is a nonprofit serving Southern Nevada, and we focus on creating access to not only groceries, but to wraparound services and supportive services so that people can get back on their feet or they can find self-sustainability and just, again, you know, that touch point to groceries when they are feeling food insecure and when food is just a struggle for them.
Why did you start the Just One Project in the first place?
You know, I volunteered and did my first charitable thing in my 30s, and it literally changed every aspect of my life. And I just thought, how many friends that I connected with on a daily basis, you know, that were not involved yet in some type of community effort. And I just simply started inviting my friends to join me with these volunteering events. And it became kind of a movement on its own to where people just wanted to start getting involved and giving back together.
So how long has the Just One Project been serving the Las Vegas community now?
So we are approaching our 10-year anniversary. We started in July of 2014 is when I applied for our 501c3, and we became an official nonprofit in November of 2014. So actually July is 10 years.
Wow, that's awesome. So happy anniversary.
Yes, thank you so much. Isn't that funny? I totally did not even remember that.
That's awesome. So what are some of the programs and services that you offer to community members through the Just One Project?
So, you know, we started out, like I said, as a volunteer organization with no age requirement. And that is really how we kind of found our start into being a nonprofit. And we slowly became introduced into the food insecurity landscape here in Southern Nevada. And that inspired us to create our first real program, which was our Pop Up and Give. And that is under our Food for All program. And so that is where we serve people through our Pop Up and Give, which is our mobile distribution. It's also our no-cost community markets. We have a few locations across town. Some are in schools, which are great. And they come with wraparound services, which is really important. And then we have 16 case managers that help people with everything from some clients are chronically homeless, some clients have unstable housing, and some clients just need some support with their utilities. That is called our Community Connect. And then we have our youth program that is our self-development arm, and that's for disconnected youth that are 16 to age 20 that are not connected to the workforce and they're not currently in the education system. And so we kind of have something for everybody, whether it be a program that you are in need of or a volunteering opportunity.
Nice. So the organization has obviously evolved over time based on the needs of the community. Why are these specific programs needed here in Nevada?
You know, we always tell people that food insecurity really doesn't fit in one certain box. It doesn't look like, you know, one certain look. And I think it's just important for people to know that there are so many reasons why somebody could be food insecure. And if somebody is facing food insecurity, the likelihood of them needing other supportive services is pretty strong. But, you know, whether it's an illness, a loss of income, a lot of our clients are just making it by. Maybe they make a dollar more an hour and they're unable to get resources, you know, like SNAP benefits. So it really is just a really important safety net for the community.
Yeah, definitely. So how many people do you think you help through your programs on, let's say, an average month?
An average month, we are seeing about 20,000 clients served, and that's over our mobile distribution, our home delivery, that is people coming into our headquarters community market at our school locations. So thanks to our volunteers, we activate over 600 volunteers every single month. And it is through that support that we're able to actively serve that many people every single month.
So you've mentioned the importance of your volunteers a few times. What sorts of opportunities are there for volunteers to get involved and help out?
Well, Monday through Friday, people come in and they distribute groceries at our headquarters location, which is conveniently located on Vegas and Decatur. We also have a Saturday volunteer opportunity, which is great for kids that have school. Again, you know, that age requirement doesn't exist with us. So really, we try to focus on removing barriers even to volunteerism.
Yeah, that's great. So I noticed that you've got a Big Cup golf tournament coming up in October. What's that all about?
Yeah, so many of our golfers say that our golf tournament is their favorite and the best in Southern Nevada. And I think it's because just like the programs that we create that are designed for our clients that we're serving, we think about our golfers and we think about what do they want to experience on the golf course? What is it that creates an incredible golf tournament? And so we have a lot of activations on the course, which is amazing. It's just such a good vibe. It's really unique. And this is our fourth annual and we're just absolutely thrilled about it.
When's it going to happen?
Our golf tournament this year is on October 17th, and we are super thrilled. The weather is going to be absolutely gorgeous, and we just love the fact that our repeat golfers come back out, and it grows over year. We have new golfers all the time, so it's just such a wonderful way to enjoy your favorite sport while also giving back to the community.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So for people who aren't golfers, what other opportunities do you have to donate or help out financially?
So, you know what? We always encourage people to look us up online, to get to know our programs, follow us on social media. Literally following us on social media, you see us in action every single day. You know, when you come and volunteer, you can see how active we are. And, you know, online donations are always absolutely amazing. We love community partnerships. Those people are really dedicated to helping us move the needle. So we're always looking to help companies give back, get involved. And of course, you know, those gift donations from companies, it's just really important for us to have these public and private partnerships, because at the end of the day, who doesn't want to pay it forward and really help move the needle with the community needs?
Yeah, absolutely. And what does it mean to be a charitable gangster?
A charitable gangster is so simple. It just means that you give and you support the Just One Project, whether you're giving the gift of your time or your treasures.
Nice. Okay. So where can listeners go if they want to find out more information, first of all, about the Just One Project, what you're doing in the community, or get involved by volunteering or donating?
They can follow us on social media, which is so easy. They can follow us online. I think everybody getting social with us would be a great, fantastic, feel-good thing, because then on newsfeed, there's going to be a lot of wonderful faces, wonderful smiles, and just invitations to get involved and give back.
And the website?
TheJustOneProject.org.
Okay, awesome. So once again, TheJustOneProject.org is the place to go if you want to find out more information about the Just One Project. There are links to all the social media sites down at the bottom as well under Get Social With Us. So you can find them on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, X, and YouTube. And you can find out more also about the upcoming Big Cup golf tournament. That's happening on Thursday, October 17th at the Revere Golf Club. All the information is also there on the website, thejustoneproject.org. And of course, we've been speaking today with Brooke Neubauer. She's the founder and CEO of the Just One Project. And Brooke, I love talking to you about all the different projects and programs that you have going on, because it seems like you're always innovating and coming up with new ways to serve the community and also giving people that opportunity to volunteer. As you said, no age limit, no minimum age, no maximum age. All ages can volunteer and help out, and of course, donating as well. So I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about what you're doing with the Just One Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We appreciate to connect with your listeners.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
Just a little heads up before something bad happens.
Move your coffee cup away from your computer.
Oh, no, 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 no.
So you can have more control.
Stop. You're texting your boss by mistake.
Uh-oh. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Warning, the cap is loose on that ketchup.
Ugh. Don't wait. You have the power to change the outcome. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Shelby Riley, rural Nevada foster care recruiter for the Division of Child and Family Services. Shelby, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me and speaking on a cause I love to talk about.
So what exactly does the Nevada Division of Child and Family Services oversee?
So we oversee a lot, but one of the things that we do is that we are the sole licensing agency for foster care in our rural counties. So if you were interested in becoming a foster parent in rural Nevada, you would be the agency we'd be working with.
And Shelby, what constitutes rural Nevada?
Rural Nevada is every county in Nevada besides Washoe and Clark County.
Okay. Now, what kind of need is there for licensed foster families in rural Nevada specifically?
Oh, there's such a need. Well, what I'll say is there's a need for foster parents nationwide, but we have such a unique need for foster parents in the rurals. In rural Nevada, we have roughly 400 children in foster care at any given time, and we roughly have about 60 foster homes across our rural counties. All of our foster homes are at max capacity at any given time, and so we're absolutely at need for more homes for ages 0 to 18.
Okay, now you mentioned that there's a need nationwide. Just as a big picture overview, what's the current foster care landscape in America?
In America, there's 400,000 children in foster care at any given time. Children enter foster care for a variety of reasons, but the most common reasons are families struggling with addiction or families struggling with inadequate services or housing.
Okay, now, as you mentioned, you deal with rural Nevada specifically. How do rural foster care needs compare to urban foster care needs?
So I think that the biggest difference to keep in mind when we're talking about rural foster care is that if there are not enough foster homes in any given small community, then those children are at risk of being displaced from their community. So we're talking about possibly taking a child that cannot now live with their mother or father, and now maybe we have to remove them so far away that they can't go to their same school. They don't get to be around their same friends. And we pretty much take them out of their entire environment, which ends up being worse off for that child than if they could be centrally located in a community where all of their services are close and familiar to them.
Okay, now you did mention that there are many different reasons, but what are some of the reasons that a child would have to be removed from their father and mother, either temporarily or permanently?
So children are removed and placed into foster care when abuse or neglect is occurring in the home. The majority of cases we work with are going to be neglect, which is an umbrella term and ultimately means that there's family crisis going on that's preventing the parents from being able to regularly keep their children safe. That can mean many different things. It could mean parents struggling with addiction. It could mean a parent is struggling to leave from an unsafe relationship. It could mean that families are struggling with adequate resources for food, for shelter, for education that they're unable to find in their rural communities. It can also mean that parents are in need of support and they don't have anyone in their world that's able to give that to them. And so that's the hope, is that the division and that foster homes are able to intervene and help build up a village for these families that are lacking without.
And how common is reunification with the parents?
Reunification is successful about 55% of the time in rural Nevada. The next statistic is that children are being adopted by family members around 30% of the time. And followed by that, about 7% of children are aging out of the foster care system when they turn 18.
Okay. So tell us about your Summer of Dads foster parent recruitment campaign.
So during this summer, we want to remind the community that foster parenting is not only the work for women. Foster dads are an equally, if not more important person in the entire foster care system for a multitude of reasons. There might be children that may do best in a male-only home. On the flip side, maybe children have had traumatic experiences with men that you as a man are able to help them overcome and learn in healing. Additionally, we have so many teen boys in the foster care system that are in such dire need of a positive male role model. You know, in the foster care system, we do like to brag that child welfare is a very woman-dominated field. The majority of our social workers, even our judges, our volunteers are all women. And we love that. We love women-dominated fields. But we also do have a population of young boys that also need that man influence and example on, you know, what life can look like for them after the foster care system.
Okay. And when we're talking about foster parents or foster families, is it typically a single individual? Is it a couple, an entire family? What do you see most often?
There are so many different makeups of what a great foster home looks like. A majority of our foster homes will be two-person households, but that is not the standard or the exception. You can be single, you can be married, you can be a part of a domestic partnership, you can be a part of a multi-generational home. So maybe you have some of your adult kids living at home, or maybe your parents are living at home. And we really want to press that there are many different homes that look like a great foster home.
What kind of qualities or skills does a foster parent need to have?
I think that if you are interested in getting creative on how you solve solutions, and you are comfortable with maybe solving solutions in ways that you never have before, if you are interested in supporting children and their families and watching an entire family reintegrate back into your system. And I think that if you're open to being an open family system versus a closed family system, being a foster parent isn't a cakewalk or easy. We're never going to say it is. But what you should know is that you have so much support lined up for you from the agency and other supportive systems around the community. So if you are someone that likes to work together with your community in coming up with creative ways to solve problems, foster parenting may be an amazing project for you.
So what kind of support does the Division of Child and Family Services provide for foster families?
So we provide a multitude of support, and that can look like a case-by-case basis based on what your family specifically needs. But in general, we do offer a monthly stipend to go towards the care for children that are in foster care. Health insurance is always covered. They usually have Medicaid or they'll have other health insurance, and foster parents are never expected to pay for medical expenses out of pocket. And then we do provide subsidized daycare. So we're able to offer daycare for foster children at a very low expense or no expense to you.
Okay, now you mentioned that it's not easy, but what's it actually like on a daily basis to be a foster parent?
To be a foster parent is to be someone that's a constant advocate for children in your community. You're going to be working with children that have likely slipped through the cracks of a lot of support systems, that have may gone through some sets of traumas that you might have not been familiar with. So you get to really be in that child's corner. You really get to instill a sense of hope and hope for a better future for these children. At the same time, you know, in some points, being a foster parent is just like being a parent to your own children. We want you to be able to give these children those same family experiences that you have with your children, being able to take them to the park, to be able to be a part of those first dance recitals or those first soccer games, to be able to take them on family vacations with you and giving them those normal child experiences that they definitely need.
What would you say to someone who would like to make a difference in a child's life, but they're just not sure about taking that step and becoming a foster parent?
I would say that if you're on the fence about being a foster parent, know that that's a totally normal spot to be in. On average, it takes about 7 times for people to hear information on foster parenting before they're ready to make that first step into inquiring and starting the process for themselves. And if that's you, that's fine, because that probably means that you're pretty planful, that you're dependable, that you're really thinking through how this could work for you in your family situation. So I would say if that's you, keep thinking and keep doing your research on being a foster parent. Look up the good, bad, and ugly online. And if you have any questions, you could always reach out to our division. There are no dumb questions you can ask about foster parenting over here.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you see all kinds of families, all kinds of foster parents, but what are the criteria to actually become a foster parent?
So our basic criteria is that you need to be at least 21 years of age. You need to be financially solvent. So you just need to be able to demonstrate that you have the income to meet your general expenses. You can be, like we said, married, single, domestic partnership. And you need to be open to working with not only the children in our system, but working with their birth families in ways that are safe and making sure that our children are able to have those regular visits with their birth family.
Okay. So for people who are thinking of becoming a foster parent, especially in rural Nevada, how can they start that process or at least that fact-finding mission?
You can get started by going onto our website. It's ruralnvfostercare.com. We've got a lot of great information. If you're ready to apply today, you can go to the bottom of our page and click the blue Get Started button. From there, you're going to have access to all the paperwork you need to start filling out. And then I will be in touch with you shortly after to talk to you about training and any questions you might have. And if you just had more questions and wanted to talk with someone real before you're putting any information about yourself online, you can always call me toll free at 888-423-2659.
Okay, awesome. So once again, that website is ruralnvfostercare.com, rural NV for Nevada. fostercare.com. You can find out plenty of information about becoming a foster parent in rural Nevada. If you're interested in starting the process, go ahead and click the blue Get Started button at the bottom of the page. And if you have questions and you'd like to talk it through, you can go ahead and give Shelby a call. The number is 1-888-423-2659, 888-423-2659. And we've been speaking today with Shelby Riley. She's the Rural Nevada Foster Care Recruiter for the Division of Child and Family Services. And Shelby, it's been great talking to you and finding out more about the foster care program in rural Nevada, specifically your needs, what you're looking for, the Summer of Dads Foster Parent Recruitment Campaign, looking for dads as well as moms, and, you know, finding out more about the foster care system in general, the landscape, not only in our own backyard, but across the country. So I really appreciate you being here and giving people a place to go if they'd like to explore and possibly take that step and become one of your next foster families. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for helping us spread our cause and our mission to keep kids safe in rural Nevada.
We weren't sure adoption would happen for us, but when it did, it happened threefold.
Mary and her husband first met their three children when they became their foster parents. Little did they know that their house would become the siblings' forever home.
We had to help them adjust to the idea that they wouldn't have to leave. Children in foster care have lived and survived so much. We had to help them process their trauma. And now to hear our children say that they know they have a mother and father who take care of us, teach us, and love us means everything.
The Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption is committed to finding safe, permanent homes for the longest waiting children in foster care.
I not only love these kids, I am just so proud of them.
You can help. Visit DaveThomasFoundation.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council, or PERC. With the new school year beginning, it's important to prioritize children's safety. The government plans to modernize the nation's school bus fleet, and that includes converting to cleaner fuel options like electric and propane. PERC is leading the charge with the Better Our Buses campaign. Tucker, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, thanks for having me.
So first of all, what kind of fuel do traditional school buses use?
Well, the traditional fuel is diesel fuel. And sadly, I think children ride to school today the way perhaps both you and I rode to school. And we just know there's a better way. And you don't have to think past that cloud of black smoke that you often see when you're behind the school bus and it pulls away from the bus stop. And we now know what's in that cloud of black smoke and harmful pollutants that are harmful to everyone, but really especially harmful to young children's, their lungs, creates asthma, bronchitis, just a host of irritants. And we've learned over the last couple of years that giving a child a better ride to school in a propane bus, they arrive at school calmer, they arrive at school ready to learn, and over the school year, they arrive much healthier because we've taken away that cloud of black smoke and given them a great start to their day.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's pretty clear that electric vehicles are better for the environment than diesel, but what are the benefits of propane?
And thanks for the question, because I think so many people skip over an intermediate step. And I do firmly believe that all school buses of the future will be either powered by propane or electric. And a lot of school systems, electric's not even a choice. Perhaps their runs are too long or the weather's too severe. But what a lot of people don't really think through is that electricity takes quite a bit of energy to make, to transport, to store. And a propane bus can be cleaner. And in fact, in 38 states, a propane bus is cleaner than an electric bus if you narrowly think about greenhouse gases. The real benefit, though, to choosing propane over an electric school bus has nothing to do with either one. It's that a propane bus is a third the cost of an electric bus. And so in choosing propane, you can get rid of those older, dirty, and expensive diesel buses to operate. You get rid of them at 3-1. So a school system can be operating a cleaner, healthier fuel, a quieter fuel, and they can do it 3 times faster by choosing propane over electric.
Interesting. Okay. Now, what communities across the country are already using propane school buses?
Well, let's start right in Nevada, because I'm happy to say that Nevada today is running about 60 propane buses. And we have a lot of fleets that started with one or two, and now they have 100% propane usage. Because once the drivers get used to it, once the mechanics get used to it, once the school system sees the savings, they just want more and more propane buses. And so we have a lot of school systems have 100% use of propane buses. I would say, though, the still the predominant bus out there today is a diesel bus. Human behavior, it takes a long time to change, but we're seeing a rapid move away from diesel and towards propane. We're excited about that.
Yeah, definitely. So what's the Better Our Buses campaign all about?
Better Our Buses campaign is a great way for first parents to go to a place to learn. I mean, the information can be daunting. We rarely think about school transportation. And we want parents to be really thinking about it, you know, to value how their child gets to and from school and to realize the importance of that great start in the morning. So Better Our Buses is a place for parents to go to get the information, to learn the questions to ask, to learn how to engage with their local leaders and inquire more about if those local leaders are in fact considering propane buses for their school fleet. It's a great website, betterourbuses.com.
Awesome. Now, on a broader scope, tell us more about the government program to invest in cleaner school buses.
Well, I think the EPA specifically sees the value of moving away from diesel. Diesel is just complex and expensive and difficult to deal with. And then EPA knows there's a better way. So there's a program in place called the EPA Clean Bus Program. And school systems can make applications to go from diesel to propane or electric, either one. And so they get a portion of the bus refunded back to them in EPA funds. It's been a really successful program for cash-starved school systems to use some of that funding to replace their buses. And when they replace those buses are not only cleaner and quieter and healthier, but they're also cheaper to operate. So it has a lasting financial impact for the school system.
Okay, fantastic. Now, if we could put all this into a nutshell, what do we really need to know about how school buses impact children's health and safety?
Parents need to understand that giving their child a ride to school in a quieter, cleaner, healthier bus gives them a better start to the day, helps their ability to learn. They're calmer. They learn better. We see it now from the testing. It's something that's so important, and parents need to stand up and ask the questions of their local leadership about how do we get our children to ride to school on a propane-powered bus.
All right. Now, where can listeners go if they want to learn more about propane and specifically the Better Our Buses campaign?
We want them to go to that website, betterourbuses.com. I'm a one-stop shop for parents to learn the facts, know how to engage, and then really start the journey on giving their child this cleaner, safer, healthier ride to school by riding in a propane-powered bus.
Nice. Okay. So once again, that website is betterourbuses.com, betterourbuses.com. That's put out by the Propane Education and Research Council. And as we've been talking about today, propane buses offer a much cleaner option to diesel. And it's one step in the direction towards EV buses, but at a third of the cost. So definitely something to look into. Now, here in Nevada, we've already got about 60 propane school buses, but there's always room for improvement. So again, you can find out more at betterourbuses.com. And we've been speaking today with Tucker Perkins. He's the president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. And Tucker, I want to thank you so much for bringing this to our attention, first of all, because I know most of us don't like big black smog coming out of the back of the school buses that comes from the diesel run school buses. And it makes complete sense what you're saying about how that affects the health and safety of our kids. So thank you for bringing this to our attention and letting us know about the different options that are out there, especially what is going on right now. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Heather, thank you. I think the good visual to leave you with is when you choose propane, that cloud of black smoke is gone. Thank you.
When a student lacks some of the most basic needs,
like food, clothing, and school supplies,
it can be challenging to even attend school.
It can be hard to study, tough to concentrate, impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue every day.
Out in the community, there are great resources for students, and we bring these resources directly to the students who need them most.
We work to ensure that they have everything they need to re-engage in learning in the classroom and at home,
including access to technology, learning materials,
and even emotional support.
By forging caring relationships with students and bringing communities of support to them,
our staff works to achieve equitable learning conditions so all kids can succeed in school and in life. And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
To learn more, visit communitiesinschools.org.
Are you a family with child medical expenses and looking for relief? United Healthcare Children's Foundation is here to help. They offer medical grants that financially help families cover costs that are not covered or not fully covered by their commercial health insurance. So far, the United Healthcare Children's Foundation has awarded more than 34,000 grants worth more than $70 million. You don't need to be insured through United Healthcare to qualify. Visit grantsforkids.org. That's grantsforkids.org and apply for a grant today.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Mona Shariari, Assistant Clinical Professor of Dermatology at Yale University School of Medicine. August is Psoriasis Action Month, and a recent study looked at the unique ways plaque psoriasis can affect people of color who have historically been underrepresented in clinical research. Dr. Shariari, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, what exactly is plaque psoriasis?
So plaque psoriasis is actually an autoimmune condition that impacts about 8 million Americans, and it's characterized by this overproduction of skin cells on the surface of the skin that leads to plaques in the elbows, knees, the scalp, as well as other areas, but it can look different depending on a patient's skin tone. So in individuals with lighter skin, it can look red, whereas in individuals with melanin-rich skin, it can look dark brown, violet, or even gray. And this can oftentimes lead to delayed diagnoses as well as misdiagnoses in patients with skin of color. Additionally, plaque psoriasis can have an impact beyond what you can see on the surface of the skin. It can impact someone's emotional health, their quality of life, with these impacts being more significant in individuals with skin of color.
Okay. Now, what are some of the most interesting findings from the recent study on plaque psoriasis in people of color?
So the VISABLE study is what I'm going to go into in a little bit more detail. But historically, patients with skin of color have been underrepresented in our clinical trials with numbers as low as 5%. So to really address this gap, Johnson & Johnson, who I'm on behalf of here today, they partnered with researchers and clinicians on the VISABLE study, which is a fully dedicated skin of color in plaque psoriasis study that evaluated Tremfya, an FDA-approved biologic for the treatment of this condition across skin tones. And we actually found rapid and significant improvements in plaque psoriasis and confirmed the safety and efficacy of this therapy across skin tones. In fact, 6 out of 10 patients had 90% improvement in their plaque psoriasis. Now, this medication is not going to work for everybody, so I do encourage patients to talk to their physician about the benefits as well as the side effects, and I do encourage patients to go to tremfya.com to learn more about the study as well as this therapy.
Now, why have clinical studies typically not focused on diversity?
I think they have tried to focus on diversity, but our patients with skin of color, they face unique challenges when it comes to access to clinical trials or access to therapy as a whole, and that can oftentimes make it challenging for a clinical trial to enroll these individuals. What was unique about VISABLE was they actually picked clinical trial sites that were in diverse locations. They picked investigators that were diverse themselves, which really improved our ability to enroll any and all patients into the study.
Okay. Now, besides the lack of access that you were just talking about, why do people of color face more challenges with plaque psoriasis?
Well, plaque psoriasis in and of itself, beyond the diagnostic challenges, can impact the scalp more severely in individuals with skin of color. We have data that shows Asians and Blacks have more severe disease, more flaking, more scaling. But many of our patients with skin of color actually have tightly coiled or textured hair, which can make traditional topical treatments a bit of a challenge. Those treatments can cause worsening of the psoriasis, breakage of the hair, and even cause dryness of the scalp. And all of these can make it a little bit more challenging for our patients with skin of color. And that's why it's important to be doing studies on systemic therapies that could potentially be an option for our patients.
So then what are some tips for people of color to both identify and then manage plaque psoriasis?
So I think the most important thing is to make sure you're speaking with your doctor about the skin condition that you have and really advocate for yourself. Because when it comes to the representation of skin of color images in our dermatology textbooks, they're limited, with 4 to 19% of images being skin of color patients. So many dermatologists may not actually have experience in diagnosing psoriasis across skin tones. So if you think you have psoriasis, you should speak with your doctor about the diagnosis and potentially the available treatment options. And I really want patients to feel empowered to have these conversations with their clinician.
Okay. And then are there other day-to-day things that people can do to kind of tame the plaque psoriasis on an ongoing basis?
There are over-the-counter moisturizers and other products that patients can certainly use, and that can work for individuals who have mild disease. But in those individuals who have moderate to severe disease, not only because of what they can see on the skin, but because of that multidimensional burden of disease that goes beyond what they can see, it is important to speak with their clinician about potentially systemic agents that could help their condition.
Okay, so let's tell it again. Where can people go if they want to learn more about plaque psoriasis, how it affects people of color, and the new medication options that are available?
I'm going to make this really easy for the audience. They can go to tremfya.com. They'll learn a lot about the VISABLE study, which is that dedicated skin of color study that we've been talking about, as well as see images of plaque psoriasis across a variety of skin tones, and they can learn more about the medications that we can use to treat this condition.
Okay, perfect. So tremfya.com, that's spelled TREMFYA.com, tremfya.com. You can find out more about the VISABLE study on plaque psoriasis. You can see images of plaque psoriasis in people of color, learn more about the condition and also the medication that is available, tremfya.com. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Mona Shariari. She's the assistant clinical professor of dermatology at Yale University School of Medicine. And Dr. Shariari, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about plaque psoriasis and also how it affects people of color differently. And the study and the advancements in medication and what they can look forward to. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did you know that those with mental health challenges can be right in front of our eyes, but still go unseen? Behind some smiles, there's hidden pain, because our struggles aren't always on the surface. And they can affect anyone, anywhere, at any time. Our Black youth are at a higher risk for depression, anxiety, and other mental health struggles. Only 1 in 4 seeks treatment, and the stigma lingers. It's okay not to feel okay. There's strength in connecting and seeking help. Break the barriers, break the silence. Sharing is healing. Share, connect, get informed. Your mental health is in your hands. Visit melaninthriving.com/mental health in your hands.
This message brought to you by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Dr. Sue Varma, psychiatrist and author of Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being. Life can be stressful, but a recent study found that nearly all Americans believe there are benefits to doing nothing. And Dr. Varma's book highlights the importance of leisure and the research behind it. Dr. Varma, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Heather.
So what are the key findings in the recent Harris Poll survey on leisure time?
So the Harris Poll survey was commissioned by Lazy Boy, and what they found was that 9 in 10 Americans consider themselves to be benefiting from laziness and equate it with self-care, which is so interesting because I'm seeing that there really is a shift towards reclaiming one's attention and time and energy for relaxation specifically.
Yeah, that's interesting because traditionally, I think a lot of people have felt guilty when they're not actually doing something. Why do we tend to get those feelings of guilt or I should be doing something?
Those should statements are so problematic. You know, in this study, 2/3 of Americans feel super guilty about taking time off. Like there's this idea that I have to earn my rest, I have to earn the lazy moments. And that's actually not the case. We know that people who take time off intentionally are the ones who are more productive in the end. So it seems counterintuitive that taking time off actually makes you more productive, actually makes you more healthy, but absolutely it does.
So for those who are not the ones who are saying, yeah, laziness is awesome, this is self-care, this is great, for those who do still feel that guilt, how can we shift our mindset and see laziness or relaxing as being beneficial?
Absolutely. And, you know, first of all, it's about being intentional. And to me, intentionality is about carving out both time and space. So that could mean like in your home, like creating a corner, a dedicated space, what I call a Zen den. And this could literally be like a throw pillow, a blanket on the floor, a yoga mat, a lazy boy recliner, whatever makes sense for you. And then giving yourself 5 minutes, 10 minutes, building out, carving out more time in your day to say, I'm going to stop everything and I'm going to see the benefits. And the benefits are undeniable, head to toe, decreased anxiety, decreased depression, less heart attacks and inflammation. So even those 5 to 10 minutes, we know that people who take naps, like 20 minutes a day, live longer. So I'm a huge fan. And I have to say, like, I wasn't always because I have those guilty moments, but I do see the benefit when I practice it.
Yeah. And I love that term, Zen den. I might have to borrow that one.
Absolutely. Please do. You have to make every lazy moment count, Heather.
That's awesome. So in the study, was there a differentiation between various age groups and generations in terms of how they viewed laziness and relaxation?
It's interesting, you know, like the extremes of age, like very young, like sort of Gen Z or like older retired baby boomers don't have as much guilt, but it's the people who are really in the thick of things, what we call like the sandwich generation. So sort of like 25 to 50, these are the folks who are running around trying to do it all. And, you know, I think it's like when you still have something either to prove or you're taking care of a young family, like aging parents, young family, these are the folks that found it the hardest, both men and women. And for different reasons, like men felt the need to always be productive. Women felt pressure to maintain family and home and friendships. And like women struggled with time management, which is something I see a lot in my practice. So it is very interesting to see how we view laziness by generation and by gender. It differs.
Yeah, yeah, that is interesting. And it's understandable that people who are in the throes of their career trying to get ahead, they're going to focus more on doing things rather than not doing things. And now it's almost like, you know, talking to you, I'm starting to feel guilty for not relaxing more. We feel guilty either way. So how 100%. Do we just stop it? You know, just stop feeling guilty.
You know, so, you know, it's so interesting because I write about this in my book and I start out by talking about my own struggles and my own difficulty being self-compassionate to myself. And to be honest with you, it's something I struggle with because I feel like we all want to be five places at one time and like we can't. And there's a saying, if you don't take care of your wellness, it will become your illness. And that's something I'm like wrapping my head around is this idea of self-compassion is about just a few minutes of saying, I deserve rest simply because I'm human. You know, I don't have to earn it. I don't have to always be productive. My self-worth isn't tied to my achievements. And I feel like it's really hard in this day and age, especially with social media, when we see people like constantly doing things, we compare ourselves. So saying to yourself, I deserve rest simply because I'm human. So the next time you feel guilty, like just have that mantra in your life on repeat almost.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Now, how is self-compassion different from self-love or self-care?
I love that. So self-compassion, and I would almost say go one step further and say one question I get asked a lot is like, how is self-compassion different from self-esteem even? And, you know, some of these things like self-esteem, and I know you didn't ask me this, but it comes to mind when you're asking me this question of how do you differentiate some of these popular terms? You know, self-esteem a lot of times has to do with like achievements and accolades. Like I got an A, so therefore I deserve rest. But it's like, if I don't get an A, if I get a C, does that mean I don't get to rest? Or if I didn't make the team or whatever the equivalent in your life is? So just keeping in mind that self-compassion says a few things, like you A, take notice of the negative thoughts, B, you accept them, and then C, you give yourself what we call common humanity, which is like, you know what, I'm not alone, I'm not the only one. And self-compassion is a form of self-love. You're saying I deserve love like anybody else, because we're so used to being compassionate to other people as compared to ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've been talking primarily about the Harris Poll survey, but what are the key lessons in your book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of this came out of my work with 9/11 survivors, and I was looking at, okay, here are folks who went through extreme trauma and stress. And I was the first medical director and I was treating both civilians and first responders. And I was like, how do we take the best of what we learn from people who bounce back from adversity, but then apply it to everyday stress? And so how do we learn how to thrive in the face of adversity? Because none of us will be able to get through life without the ups and the downs, hopefully not the life-threatening kind. But there are 8 pillars, and it starts out with having a purpose in life and being very intentional. So even like the laziness, like if you want to achieve something, if you want to have self-rest, whatever your goals might be, to be very intentional. Exercise helps boost a sense of purpose. Volunteering helps boost a sense of purpose. And I always say, put the cart before the horse. If you don't feel like you have a sense of purpose, it's your job to create it. And then the next step is about processing emotions. And I give people like easy steps. Name it, claim it, tame it, and reframe it. Name the thing that's bothering you. Claim it. Where in the body are you feeling it? And this is something you can do, if, you know, when you're at home, in your recliner, you know, in your Zen den. Tame it is doing a deep breathing. And so like for me, like, you know, I love myself, the lazy boy recliners, and I'm on it and I'm doing my deep breathing, but it could be a yoga mat on the floor. And then reframe it. How do I change the way my outlook? So much about practical optimism is understanding that some of us are not going to be born with the glass half full thinking. In fact, only 25% of us are optimistic by nature, by birth. The rest of us have to, 75% have to work at it. And so going through these 8 pillars of having a purpose, being very intentional, processing your emotions, reframing them. All the way, the 8th one is about cultivating good habits by making them simple, easy. And I dedicate a whole chapter to self-compassion and a whole chapter to being present. And it's all about leisure and laziness and reclaiming your time and attention, I think, that we've lost in a digital age.
Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, so where can listeners go if they want to find out more about the benefits of relaxing or even get your book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being?
Thank you so much. So, you know, again, we want to make every lazy moment count. And I say, like, you know, to learn more, you can visit the nearest Lazy Boy store or lazyboy.com. And the book, thank you so much for mentioning it. It's available wherever books are sold. So Amazon, your local bookstore, you name it.
All right. Fantastic. So lazyboy.com, if you want to explore the new recliners that are available out there so you can take your time and relax, or visit your local Lazy Boy store. And Dr. Sue Varma's book, Practical Optimism, The Art, Science, and Practice of Exceptional Well-Being, can be found wherever you buy your books, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And of course, we've been speaking today with Dr. Sue Varma. She's a psychiatrist and author of that book, Practical Optimism. And Dr. Varma, it's been fantastic talking to you and finding out, first of all, the benefits of relaxing more and how not to feel guilty about it, how to have compassion for ourselves. So a lot of fantastic messages that you've shared today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me and talking about this. I really appreciate it, Heather. Take care. Be well.
Attention high school sports fans, are you an armchair official? You know, the parent or fan who constantly yells at the referees and loves to let everyone know just how bad you think they are. Well, if you think you could do better, then get in the game and prove it. It's time for you to suit up and make the calls where they actually count. Every sport in Nevada needs more officials. Sign up today at highschoolofficials.com.
Everyone has a community to lean on. A neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use. You've talked with your kids and shared clear expectations, but you're not with them every minute. Your community members, friends and relatives, teachers and coaches, faith leaders, and other important adults in your kids' lives can be your eyes, ears, and a supportive influence when you're not around, reinforcing your messages with your kids and alerting you to warning signs of underage drinking or other substance use. So talk with your kids about these issues and involve the members of your community to help keep your kids safe, because when you talk, they hear you. For more information, visit talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, August 19th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Adelson Clinic, and Monday, September 9th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Unforgettables Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Las Vegas Rescue Mission is holding their annual bottled water drive through August 31st. When the summer is hot, people experiencing homelessness need water more than ever. You can drop off bottled water donations at the Las Vegas Rescue Mission security gate 24/7. Find out more at vegasrescue.org. That's vegasrescue.org. ADL's annual Walk Against Hate is happening on Sunday, September 29th, with doors at 8:30 a.m. and program at 10 a.m. at Las Vegas Ballpark. Proceeds from the walk benefit a variety of initiatives, including the award-winning No Place for Hate program in K-12 schools throughout Nevada. Register to walk or find out more at walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. That's walkagainsthate.org/LVWalkAgainstHate. The Nevada chapter of the Bleeding Disorders Foundation is holding their annual Unite for Bleeding Disorders Walk on Saturday, October 12th, with opening ceremonies at 10 a.m. and the walk starting at 10:30 a.m., followed by a picnic lunch at 11:15 at Floyd Lamb Park. A variety of prizes will be awarded for the top teams and individuals, and if you personally raise or donate $25 or more, you'll receive a special Unite for Bleeding Disorders t-shirt. Find out the details or register to walk at uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. That's uniteforbleedingdisorders.org. And the Just One Project's hosting the fourth annual Big Cup Golf Tournament on Thursday, October 17th at the Revere Golf Club. Join the organization and their sponsors on the green to raise funds for the Just One Project programs with friendly competition, food, and drinks. Find out more or sign up to play at thejustoneproject.org. That's thejustoneproject.org.